Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Today, hot button social issues. Shortly, we'll look at moves to legalise assisted dying in Victoria and New South Wales. But first, to the High Court's decision that gave a green light to the non-binding postal survey on same-sex marriage, and also to moves to now apply the standard election advertising rules and also anti-vilification laws to this survey. University of Queensland Professor Graham Orr is an expert on electoral law. He's not usually a betting man, but he did make some money last week on a sports betting punt. Graham Orr, tell us about your bet.
Oh, well, Sportsbet were stupid enough to put up a book on something like a court case. And beside the risk of insider trading, if there was an unethical associate out there, unlikely, of course, a lot of us who are looking at the law behind this case looked at the odds and thought the government really is quite likely to win this case. So although I wouldn't normally bet on elections, a friendly wager is one thing. I don't like industrial betting on politics and law. I thought if they're silly enough to have a book on something that's predictable, I'll place a bet.
How much did you win?
That's between me and my accountant.
Okay. Now, you describe the postal ballot as a plebby survey. Why?
Oh, well, others have copyright to that term, Michael Maley and Dominic Knight. But it's neither a traditional plebiscite run by the Electoral Commission with in-person voting, and nor is it a sort of traditional survey either. It's this funny platypus halfway in between, and it really is quite an unusual plan C that the government has hatched here to get around the Senate and to get around some concerns they had about their ability to budget for this.
Okay, so let's get down to the decision last week. The court handed down its ruling, but without any accompanying reasons. Those will be handed down sometime down the track. What do we know about what the court decided?
Well, obviously, they said the government had the power, which is not the same as approving the plebiscite as a good or bad thing. It had to decide two broad things, and interesting, neither relate to marriage, neither even relate directly, at least, to the law of elections, democracy, or even the Constitution. One of the things they had to decide involved budgeting, so government allocation of money. The other was the role of the Bureau of Statistics in collecting statistical information and what statistical information meant. And both issues actually came down to statutory interpretation.
So what did they decide? Let's break those down. First of all, the government had the power to spend the money?
When it came to the substantive questions, the power to spend money, firstly, the court has held that the finance minister not only has a flexible pot of funds in an appropriation act for him to allocate, they've said that that's broad flexibility and that Mr. Cormann was within his discretion in using these $120-odd million for a, quote, urgent and unforeseen policy option to run a plebby survey. And that raised some eyebrows because, of course, the government has known for, well, more than a year that it wanted to have some kind of plebiscite on this issue. It was really on the means to the end that was unexpected.
And there was also this issue around what is statistics and whether the ABS was legally able to conduct this postal survey, right?
Yeah, so whether the ABS is within its power, that goes back in very old legislation. And for me, partly because I used to be a tutor in statistics at university, not a very good one, I think this will be the most curious part of the reasoning because the court has never really had to consider the census and statistics power. I think there was a respectable argument for the plaintiffs that statistics is a science based on proper sampling. So the odd thing about this non-binding voluntary postal survey is that you would get a more accurate representation of the total population if you just held a giant official opinion poll. But the government, for political reasons, has decided to treat it effectively like a mini referendum. So the questions of turnout and whether that turnout be skewed towards older people or people with bees in their bonnets is a real live issue. But the court, I assume, has decided to adopt a broad reading of the notion of statistics, consistent with its tradition that the court will broadly interpret constitutional powers. And in this case, I guess no one's rights are directly affected by this, so they felt no need to read down the term statistics. And so the ABS in future might be used for a whole lot of data gathering. We just don't know, because just about everything in modern society can be reduced to binary code and numbers, and we're not sure what statistics outer boundaries will be.
Mm. Graham Orr, looking beyond the same-sex marriage plebiscite, what do you see as the significance of this ruling? Are there any kind of broader conclusions we can draw?
Yeah, so I mean, essentially, this has been a political stoush, a social and political stoush, and this is an unusual plebi survey or platypus in law. So I don't think there's a lot of precedential value going to come directly from this case. But as I said, it does raise the spectre of the Bureau of Statistics potentially being turned into a kind of market research arm of government if it doesn't have to collect just statistically valid sampling material. That would be a shame for its reputation in the future, but at least the Bureau of Statistics data is made public, unlike a lot of government consultation and market research. I think more broadly, though, what we've got here is the potential politically for governments to go down the path of a kind of ad hoc citizens referendum, but without citizens proposing the referenda and without the usual checks and balances on referendums and votes that we might speak about in a moment. So the political branches don't come out of this years-long stoush very well. But I think the court has come out of this quite well. Wait to see its reasons, because it would have been a shame if the court had said the government, the Senate could basically block the government spending money on public consultations. Not that I think this plebi survey is a good idea at all, but when it comes to the power generally of governments in the future to consult with people, you wouldn't want the court to be being called into play every time someone in officious bystander wanted to say, question the government's power to spend money on public consultation in advance of policy making.
So you're saying that there's that issue about the ABS and the way it's used, but what about this other broader issue about the government's ability to spend its money?
This is where the case, not directly in terms of its precedent, but in terms of its general outcomes, fits into a decade-long question about limits on executive spending power in cases involving the school chaplains and the GFC cash splash. So the court has in the past decade said, in the interest of federalism, they might rein in Commonwealth spending power to allow the states more space to play. And the courts have in the past said they're more interested in ensuring that Parliament has oversight of expenditure. But the courts would want to be wary of getting involved in policing government spending too much. Executive governments need flexibility to spend. And ultimately, there are mechanisms to question whether this was wise expenditure. Mm. There are parliamentary mechanisms where the Senate can question the Bureau of Statistics, ministerial staff, and so on. So it's not like there's no oversight, even if the courts are reluctant to get involved.
Now, on the flip side, do you see any dangers for our established system of representative government, where Parliament is meant to ultimately decide, you know, most important big picture things?
Oh, yeah. Look, this plebis survey is a very odd creature, and I hope it's a train that has a ticket for one day, as they say. It's a non-binding voluntary postal ballot where the government has said they will only move on the issue if there's a yes vote, but if there's a no vote, that'll block it for the life of this parliament. Now, that actually inverts the logic of citizens' referenda in places like states in the United States where these things are set up systemically. So in the United States, for example, if a citizens' referendum passes, that becomes the law. But if it doesn't pass, but there's still momentum and interest in change, then the parliament can take it up. So I don't want us to sleepwalk away from representative government just because our political system is a bit fractured and blocked on certain issues like this. If we really want to go down the track of direct democracy, we need to do that systemically. We need to set up processes for good deliberation in proper referenda. And then we also have to think about the risks of that. So if you have direct democracy on every issue, then you lose something of the holistic nature of government, where the executive and the cabinet and the parliament are investigating and putting forward issues as a whole and not just one by one.
Mm. Now, Graeme Orr, you described this survey as hopefully a train ticket just for one day. Well, the government is talking about laws just for one day. The government has said that it wants to legislate to ensure that advertising for the yes and the no cases meets the usual electoral rules and standards, including protections against malicious publications and bribery. And it's also just announced today, after consultation with the ALP, it wants to legislate to prevent vilification, intimidation, or threatening to cause harm on the basis of, I guess, sexual orientation or religious convictions. This is just during the survey period. And anyone found to have breached those provisions could incur a $12,600 fine and a court injunction. There are two issues here. Let's talk first about how straightforward will it be to mirror the standard election laws and rules?
Well, it's not. There's two things. What is the substance of the rules that might emerge from the hurried negotiations this week? There's a furphy going round that elections are well regulated for deliberative debate. They're obviously not. Justice Michael Kirby, of all people, famously in a defamation case involving two Labor Party activists at an election, said that Australian political campaigns are not just robust, but they're full of invective, exciting, angry, passionate speech involving prejudice as well as fact and comment. Now, Justice Kirby would oppose this plebi-survey because he would say, look, on a very special social issue, you don't want that level of partisanship. We've already seen some ugly campaigning. But there's nothing in normal electoral law to stop ugly, robust campaigning. So there are certainly rules to protect the integrity of the secret ballot, and they, I assume, will be adopted by the Parliament to cover the plebi survey. So, for example, if a father sits down at a table and says to everyone in the family, give me your postal ballots, I'll fill them in, that may well be made an offence.
And what about Tuesday's announcement that anti-vilification provisions will be included as part of this legislative package?
Yeah, and then we get into a constitutional question, as well as a question about, you know, free speech versus respectful deliberation. The constitutional question is this: the Commonwealth does not have broad power to police speech and general human activity. That normally lies with the states. So there are some state anti-discrimination laws, though they tend not to protect vilification of groups by sexuality. They might protect individuals, but this debate will be about potentially attacks on people as bigots or perverts or whatever. So the Commonwealth will have to rely on uncertain powers. Probably the most obvious power here would be the power of the internet and broadcasting. So if they really want to go down the path of cobbling together anti-vilification laws just for this plebi survey, they might only be able to cover the broadcast and internet domain and not printed material. The reason for that is that whilst it's clearly incidental and within Commonwealth power to regulate the integrity of the survey, in other words, the counting of the votes, for example, the secret ballot, it's not necessarily and unlikely to be incidental to the survey for the Commonwealth to regulate holus bolus the debate behind the survey. So they may have to cobble together a bunch of different powers, and that may leave the legislation open to some challenge by anyone who is prosecuted under it. But this has been such a moving feast, we really do not know what's going to happen here, and it's been nothing more than an interesting schmozzle.
Well, we'll be fascinating to see what happens. Professor Graham Orr from the University of Queensland, electoral law expert, thanks so much for speaking to the Law Report.
You're welcome.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast on ABC RN, ABC News Radio and Radio Australia. Or you might be listening to a podcast via the ABC Listen app. Same-sex marriage isn't the only hot-button social issue that is taking centre stage. The parliaments of Victoria and New South Wales will soon be considering laws that could legalise voluntary euthanasia, or perhaps more correctly, legalise assisted dying. The Victorian government could present this legislation to its lower house as soon as next week. Colleen Cartwright is an emeritus professor in aged services at Southern Cross University, and she's also principal of Cartwright Consulting. She says when talking about the proposed Victorian law, it's very important to use the right language.
Well, it's not to legalise voluntary euthanasia. That's the first thing. Euthanasia is generally understood, active voluntary euthanasia, where a medical practitioner gives a lethal injection to someone at their request. They've made a very big deal about the terminology, and I think they're absolutely correct. This is assisted dying. This is legislation that will allow someone who is terminally ill and meets the selection criteria to request assistance themselves to end their own life. They've purposely not used the term suicide because it isn't. This person is dying. They are just being given some assistance over the timing of that. And it's not euthanasia because it's not the medical practitioner performing the action, except in a very few limited cases where the person themselves cannot do it.
So if you are deemed eligible, in other words, I think you're expected to die within a finite amount of time, you will be provided with medication that you will then yourself ingest or inject yourself. How will this system work?
The eligibility criteria is very tight. It's actually probably the tightest in the world, Damien. Firstly, you have to be an adult, 18 years or over. You have to be ordinarily resident in Victoria and an Australian citizen or permanent resident. You have to have decision-making capacity in relation to voluntary assisted dying, and you have to be diagnosed with an incurable disease, illness or medical condition that is advanced, progressive and will cause death, is expected to cause death within weeks or months but not longer than 12 months, and is causing suffering from the viewpoint of the patient, which is all it ever should be, suffering that can't be relieved in a manner that the person deems tolerable. So that's the eligibility criteria, and that is quite tight compared to other places in the world where assisted dying is allowed.
And if you tick all those boxes, you will what? You will be provided with a drug which you can then ingest.
Not that easily. Firstly, you can raise the issue with your treating medical practitioner without that committing you in any way, but you can request information. If your medical practitioner is prepared to assist you, then you make an initial request. There's three separate requests. The first one is you have to make a verbal one, then you have to undergo two independent medical assessments to ensure that you meet all the eligibility criteria. Then you make a written one, and then you have a final one. And there are two doctors involved in the process.
And if you go through that process, then they will provide you with a drug which you yourself have to ingest,
unless you are physically
incapacitated.
Unless you're physically incapacitated. In some jurisdictions, if you really don't want to do it yourself, then your medical practitioner has the option. In this, that's not the case. If you can do it yourself, you have to do it yourself.
And you would describe what is being proposed in Victoria is quite conservative and narrow compared to the systems which operate in parts of North America and parts of Western Europe.
Yes. Oregon in the United States has, they call it physician-assisted suicide, but it's a similar process. Whereas in Belgium and the Netherlands and other places, it's more open and people can request that the doctor gives them the injection. I think one of the points to make is that wherever legislation allows people to be assisted, it's in less than 4% of all deaths in any of those countries.
And Colleen Cartwright, there's also a process taking place in New South Wales. Their parliament will at some point also consider legislation. Is that roughly similar to what the Victorians are proposing?
The New South Wales legislation has already been notice given that they're about to present the bill to Parliament in New South Wales, so it's a bit further down the track in Victoria, but it's called the Voluntary Assisted Dying Bill, and it was drafted by a multi-party working party, so it's not just the voice of any one party or faction. But I have some concerns about the New South Wales proposal. My major concern is the first of the eligibility criteria there. As I said to you, Victoria, it's 18 and all of the other steps. The first eligibility criteria in New South Wales says that the patient must be at least 25 years of age. Now, that, I believe, is both discriminatory and illogical. Throughout Australia and much of the developed world, the definition of adult is 18 years of age or above. And think about it, Damien. At 18, we send our citizens to war. We allow them to drive and we allow them to go into pubs and clubs. But more than that, for all other intents and purposes, an adult is aged 18 in all our jurisdictions. And there's very good research that says a young person, for example, who has had a chronic disease or a long-term illness, are often much more mature. So setting the first eligibility criteria in New South Wales at 25 just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So you've got concerns about that 25-year age eligibility condition. Do you have any other issues with the New South Wales proposal?
The other one is that they can ask another person, not the doctor. So I'm assuming that means hold the cup or other vessel containing the lethal substance or giving the patient a lethal injection. So while it's a necessary and sensible provision that if the person can't administer it to themselves, that a medical practitioner can do so. So that means a person with a physical disability isn't being discriminated against, prevented from accessing something which is available to the rest of the community. But if the patient can nominate another person, take, for example, a partner, a family member or a friend who's asked to do that. Not only might they feel unable to refuse, but they might be left with lasting emotional and mental distress. And in addition, what if something goes wrong in the process? If it's a doctor who's assisting, then they would know what to do. But an untrained person wouldn't. That one does trouble me a bit in the New South Wales one as well.
How far along is this New South Wales proposal?
They've already told the Legislative Council that it's about to be presented. They made their announcement ahead of the Victorian one, and they will be presenting it to their Parliament within the next weeks.
Mm. Just before we move away from New South Wales, and is there at this stage of the game any possibility that what's being proposed might be amended, or it's now pretty much set in stone?
Well, no. I guess once the legislation is presented to Parliament, then that's the point at which debate will begin. And I would think that I'd be surprised if those two points that I made there are not debated and hopefully amended.
So we have these processes taking place in Victoria and in New South Wales.
Mm.
Of course, the Northern Territory did some 20 years ago have a system of, well, I'm using the term legalised voluntary euthanasia. I don't know if you'd characterise it that way.
Oh, yes, in the Territory it was.
Yeah. What lessons can we learn from that experience in terms of the way opinions are formulated around this very, very contentious issue? And of course, it is an important one which we must all turn our minds to. Your garage actually contains 12,578 submissions from the public that were sent to the Commonwealth Government on this issue. Why are they in your garage, and what exactly are they?
Okay. Well, first we're talking about the Northern Territory Rights of the Terminally Ill Act, which was passed in 1995 and overturned by the Commonwealth Government's Euthanasia Laws Act in 1997. As you would probably be aware, had that legislation been passed in a state and not a territory, it could not have been overturned by the Commonwealth. And that had implications also for how people responded. But the Commission of Inquiry that it called for submissions around the Euthanasia Laws Act, it's often called the Andrews Bill because Kevin Andrews put the bill up. What happened was that churches and other organisations throughout Australia asked their parishioners to collect form letters from their presbyteries and use them as the basis for submissions against euthanasia.
Did the government invite public submissions on
this? Oh, yes.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, John Howard said we have to work very hard to, he called for national action to overturn the legislation. So the 12,578 written submissions were received. And the Commission said that 93% were in favour of overturning the legislation.
And those 12,578 submissions that somehow ended up in your garage, how did they actually end up in your garage?
Well, I had made a submission and I had talked to the person running the secretariat, and I was asked at the end of the, would you be interested in having these submissions? Well, as a researcher, and I said, absolutely, thank you very much. And I was planning, Damien, to use them in writing a book about what really happened in the NT as my retirement project. But, you know, I'm 74 next month and I don't ever intend to retire. So they've been sitting there for a while.
And how many boxes are there?
There's six or seven big cardboard ones. They're actually now in my office since I've been going through them. But yes, they have moved from garage to garage over the years. And they made fascinating reading.
What have you found in these submissions as you've gone through them?
There was so much misinformation, which was really, really disturbing. The churches ask people to come around to the presbytery, and the form letters, it says across the top of each form letter, not just from the churches, from various groups, do not send this page, use the material in it to write your own submission. But at least 500 people just sent the form letter. And I have to say, in one of them, one of the groups, the information they had in the form letter was so wrong, and so they know it's a lie to say that what the Nazis did was euthanasia. What the Nazis did was murder and genocide. Euthanasia, in its original meaning from the Greek word, is a good or peaceful death. How could anybody describe what the Nazis did as a good or peaceful death? But that's what was in some of these form letters. Quite a lot of the submissions talked about God, and only God has the right to take life. And as I said, there were hundreds of form letters. But the other thing is petitions. Some of the voluntary euthanasia societies took up petitions and had several thousand signatures on them. Each of those petitions was counted as one submission in favour of retaining the legislation. But in the same vein, I saw a submission from a Chinese Presbyterian church which had 228 form letters attached, a very brief introduction in English, the main part in Chinese, absolutely identical, each one signed. Now, they were counted as 229 submissions against euthanasia. So there was also some fudging.
And why do you think it's important to talk about those submissions now as Victoria and New South Wales start having a big conversation about this issue? Why go back to what took place 20 years ago?
Because it's happening again, Damien.
How?
There are people, the anti-euthanasia people in both of those states are contacting the members of their churches or their local members of parliament, and they're telling the same lies all over again. Now, I don't have a problem with people being for or anti. I managed to stay neutral on whether or not the law should be changed for 25 years. But I do have a problem with people taking the high moral ground, talking about God and all the rest, and then telling deliberate porcupines. They know that what they're saying is not true.
You know, this is a very heartfelt issue, and people will have very, very strong views. And they will, if you believe in the sanctity of life, be very troubled by what they would regard as a slippery slope. I don't know, you're catching that opposition and the articulation of that opposition as people being told lies and people then repeating them. But they are just...
That's not what I'm doing.
Views.
No, that's not what I'm doing. I'm not saying that people should not be opposed to euthanasia. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that there is no evidence of the slippery slope. In countries where this has been 20 years in existence, the figures have not gone up. There was evidence prior to the legislation that more assisted dying was happening than has happened since. The reporting is strict and rigid. Damien, you only have to read the provisions of the legislation, of the proposed legislation, to see that you have to jump through many, many hoops. So you have to be diagnosed. It has to absolutely be your request, voluntary request. Nobody's going to be bumped off by some do-gooder doctor. Judy Dent, the wife of the man in the Northern Territory who was the first to receive euthanasia, she said recently, to achieve assistance to end your life, you have to really, really, really want it, and you have to really, really, really prove that you do. So as I said, fears that euthanasia is cheaper than good palliative care. Well, in the Northern Territory, the funding for palliative care increased dramatically once the euthanasia legislation was in place.
So in light of your sifting through these 12,000 submissions and your analysis of them, what lessons do you want people to take away? Or what do you want to tell people about that experience and about that learning?
So for whatever reason, if you are for or against euthanasia, I just urge people to please get your facts right. It's not going to be something that's easily available. It's not going to be something that'll be used to bump off older people.
Colleen Cartwright, Emeritus Professor in Aged Services at Southern Cross University and also Principal of Cartwright Consulting. That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to technical producer Kieran Ruffles. Talk to you next week with more Law.